Iku Iluna, please rise. Ohea alko eko ka aha, inahe kuliana imue okea aha, ho o kolo kolo ki eki hanohano, o ka moku aina o Hawaii, inai mai, e maleo mai, ilohi ia ka leo. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye, all persons having any business before this honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii, draw nigh. Give your attention and shall be heard. Inono ilalo, please be seated.
Makamoku puni o ahu I kamoku o kona e ano no ka komau ali'i o lani hale and greetings. On the island of Oahu in the district of Kona, we are gathered here at ali'i o lani hale. Please call the case.
Case number SCCQ-25-000822. Lori Bolis et al. On behalf of her and all others similarly situated plaintiffs versus Waldorf Astoria Management LLC operating as Grand Wailea, a Waldorf Astoria Resort et al. Defendants. Arguing for the plaintiffs, Lori Bolis et al., Brittany Harmson, also appearing as Sandra Lynch and Marty LaPointe. Arguing for the defendants, Waldorf Astoria Management LLC, Nathaniel Garrett. Also appearing is Judy Irie. Argument on the merits.
All right. Aloha kakahiaka. Good morning. Today's proceeding is being broadcast live on the Judiciary's YouTube channel and on Olelo. And I'd like to welcome our substitute justice in this case, Judge Henry Nakamoto. Counsel, are you ready to proceed?
Yes.
All right. Thank you. The court has allowed 30 minutes for each side. And just to confirm, Ms. Harmson,
yes.
I understand you intend to argue for 20 minutes and have reserved 10 minutes for rebuttal. And Mr. Garrett, you will have 30 minutes with a 5-minute warning. So, Ms. Harmson, please proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Britt Harmson, formerly from Maui, now in the Bay Area. I'm here with the original named plaintiff. From our case, Lori Bolis, who's back there, along with my family cheering section. Hopefully they'll be quiet today. So my goal today is twofold. First, I will try not to have a baby in this courtroom. I am 8 months pregnant, as you might have noticed. And secondly, to assist the court with the question at hand. We're very grateful. I want to start by saying that we're very grateful to this court for proceeding with oral argument today because this case is not moot. A case becomes moot only when it's impossible for a court to grant any effectual relief whatever to the prevailing party. And here, plaintiffs have not yet received complete relief. And the answer is dispositive, actually, to determining liability under the minimum wage cause of action and the proper allocation of damages through our settlement recovery. So a live controversy thus remains. But turning to the question presented, the fundamental question we are addressing today is not whether Hawaii's minimum wage law permits workweek averaging for purposes of determining minimum wage liability. It does not. That answer is no. But whether hours of work, and in this case, hours upon hours upon hours of work, can go unpaid under Hawaii law, that answer is also no. What we have here in this case is complete non-payment, not underpayment for low productivity periods. So there couldn't be a clearer case for illustrating why the statute requires an hourly minimum wage floor.
Counsel, may I ask you, what's your response to the hotel's dual coverage argument?
The dual coverage argument? So I that's evidence. I believe that that's evidence of the legislature's intentional departure from the federal law, and meaning that during that time frame in the early 1960s when the FLSA was amended repeatedly, the legislature took action to amend Hawaii law as well. But to be more protective of their workers, the dual coverage provision, I believe, is represents just that, clearly delineating between federal law and Hawaii law and providing more protections, making it clear that whichever law was more favorable would apply to Hawaii workers. So I think it's just further evidence of an intent to depart from federal law, even though the law was modeled after the FLSA.
Federal law uses an hour. State law uses per hour. Seems like the same thing.
I don't disagree with you, but I think per hour, I think, denotes an application to each hour. I don't believe that that terminology is especially important, as they noted in their answering brief, that the legislature has at times used an hour, at times has used per hour. But what we do see is that after the 1960s period, when work week was codified into the FLSA language and Hawaii did not follow suit, what we do see is since that time frame, per hour has been used consistently, and an hour has been used consistently in the federal counterpart. So I do believe that at least is significant.
Well, I mean, it does seem that over the years there's been multiple amendments in Hawaii law, and as you point out, it was used interchangeably, an and per. So I guess I'm just wondering if that distinction is really, really, I guess, doing the work you claim it's doing.
No, I think that there's other stronger textual support for why per hour, why Hawaii law denotes that as the unit of compliance. And I think the most obvious being the obvious omission of the term work week from the Hawaii counterpart.
Before you jump into another area, what I am most curious about is, you know, in Hawaii we have, and this court has stated a number of times that we should defer to the expertise of agencies in various circumstances. And here, I guess the State Department of Labor's wage and hour enforcement manual, as the defendants point out, specifically address how they're going to enforce 387-2. So I know you're familiar with the argument, and it specifically references utilizing that work week analysis. So I'd like you to address why this provision or this manual should not be given the deference that we have sort of spoken to in past cases, and why only in March of 1981, what happened in March of 1981, if we know.
Okay. I'll start.
Yeah, two-part question.
Yeah, thank you, Your Honor. So I'll start with the first question relating to why the court shouldn't defer to that. As the manual clearly states, it is an internal discretionary enforcement approach. And actually, the other plaintiffs submitted a wage and hour manual from 1942. I believe it was referenced in their answering brief, but from the Department of Labor, which was the first to kind of adopt this enforcement approach. But that's exactly what it is. And that's the case, the same with the federal law. It's an enforcement, discretionary enforcement approach for administrative convenience. And in that original 1942 manual, when this work week approach was formally adopted by general counsel, it explicitly talked about precisely the court's role in deciding that whether that was an appropriate application, and actually pointed out almost the exact facts we have in this case, that a court could find that that would not be lawful, given a circumstance where employees are sometimes working, and we have plaintiffs who worked entire shifts, like think 6 hours straight of work where they're compelled to be there. The employer controls whether they have an appointment at all. And so all of that waiting time, they contemplated the circumstance and said, yeah.
So what I understand is your argument is that it's an enforcement sort of policy.
Yes. Only.
Those are the cases where they'll go after folks, I suppose. I do recognize that very paragraph starts with a strict interpretation of the law would require payment of at least the minimum wage for each hour of work. So I think, is that what you're speaking to in terms of what perhaps a court may view differently?
Yes, exactly. And in the case of that enforcement manual in Hawaii, what we're dealing here is it's a case of statutory interpretation. These are, you know, again, this is they're tasked with enforcing the statute, but neither of those publications are interpreting the statute. They both, in fact, interpret it to require hourly compliance, even under federal law.
Okay, so question two, the 1981, is there anything particularly that happened in 1981 that you think is relevant here?
I wish I knew the answer. I wasn't even born in 1981, but
nothing in the record that indicates that this particular manual in 81, I guess because I saw in the briefing a reference that this is the manual that applied, at least as of 1981, was the enforcement policy. So I just wanted to understand.
Yeah, well, I question that as well, given that, and this was supplied as a notice or request for supplemental authority, but I was able to obtain the public records request that defendants submitted to the agency, which specifically requested any sort of indication materials that suggested that this enforcement approach was ever adopted or applied in practice. And the agency produced zero evidence of that. So we can only say that in 1981, this was part of an internal enforcement manual, but there's no evidence that the agency has in fact applied it in this manner. And in fact, I think the existing guidance that we have from the agency is reflective of hourly compliance, insofar as their publications refer to waiting time, reporting time, rest breaks, working through meal periods that has to be compensated at the regular rate. And I think in looking at the broader statutory scheme in Hawaii with Chapter 88, further evidence that Hawaii law is much more protective of its workers. There's no federal counterpart to Chapter 88.
You know, we talk about the DLIR, and we're talking about post-1981, and I read the U.S. District Court certification order, and it says, and it notes that on the DLIR's FAQs, that it provides some support for plaintiff's position that they should be paid for all hours worked. So there's that, and I guess that would be a response to the question. But, I mean, your argument just is the text and per hour means per hour and that the statute's not ambiguous, so why should we even get to these other things? Or are you suggesting somehow that the statute is ambiguous, like the Ninth Circuit in Douglas?
No. I believe that the statute is unambiguous, and many federal courts applying state law with the same identical text have found that hourly compliance is required. Washington and Carranza's same exact language. I will go through all the cases, but any court that's dealt with this language has held the same, that hourly compliance is required. But I raised those arguments.
Well, when you say other courts, well, how do you distinguish some of the courts that the defendants mentioned, for example, Pennsylvania and a few other states?
Thank you, Your Honor. I'm excited. Okay. So in those cases, those were very clearly distinguishable. In Masterson, for example, the Pennsylvania Act included work week averaging elsewhere in the Act itself, and relative to criminal penalties under the statute. And so it would follow. It would make sense. You can't be imposing criminal penalties for violating based on a work week averaging approach and then adopt a whole different standard elsewhere in the Act. And Roop, the Florida statute, there's no language per hour whatsoever. And finally, I believe it was Wilkin. In that case, in Oregon, work week averaging was expressly adopted in a regulation itself, not agency guidance. So those are...
I'm hoping that you can help me understand the argument. Your argument is that a person needs to be paid the minimum wage per hour worked. Is that correct?
Yes.
So does that mean, for example, I understand some of your the class members would include people that were receiving commission for one type of activity or another. And so let's say in the first hour there was nothing, but in the second hour they receive a $200 commission. So is it, and then the third hour there's nothing. So you're indicating that for the first hour they would still get the minimum wage, and the third hour they would still get the minimum wage, plus they get the $200 commission for the second hour. So this means that employers would have to, like, how do they figure out which hour the commission was earned? In other words, do they have to, you know, like, check the cash register to see exactly what time that sale was recorded and which they earned the commission? I'm a little bit confused as to the practical way in which your argument would work.
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. It's actually much simpler than the alternative, because what we had in this situation, they didn't even have time records. They only knew when workers...
Many employers don't keep those types of time records, right? Like exactly what time a sale was made.
And by that I mean they didn't have any record of them ever clocking in at work. They only...
let's assume they do that. So, okay, and then let's get to my fact pattern where it's an 8-hour day and first hour, no sales, second hour, significant, third hour, no, nothing. Sure. How does that work? How does an employer calculate that?
So typically how it's done in other jurisdictions, and now I'm living in California, so we do that there. But you credit the commission, if it's a commission or whether it's piece rate, whatever incentive base, toward the time that it was actually earned.
And how do you figure that out? When was it actually earned? Is it when it was... rung up, or sometimes they're standing in line at the cashier for a while. I mean, what time is it allocated to?
So it would be in this case, if they're performing a spa service, it'd be the start of the spa appointment time,
and it'd be start of the what?
The spa appointment time. I'm trying to do a real world application of how it would work. It would apply to when the service time was set to begin.
Begin, not end.
Correct.
Not when payment was made.
Not when payment is made. It's because that's consistent with what we see in other.
What about? I understand that some of your clients were also required to work in the gift shop. How does that work? How does that work if they receive commission for, I don't know if they did receive commission for gift shop work. I thought they did. No?
No.
Oh, they didn't get anything for gift shop work.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So it would only be for, so you're saying you would calculate it from the time. So is it when it actually starts or when it was scheduled to start?
It would be, I think that.
You know what I mean?
Like, yeah, I understand.
Start a minute earlier, five minutes early.
Yeah, so of course. I think it would be when the scheduled appointment began. But importantly, the commissions are credited toward that time work and then any other unpaid time.
So there's no even averaging for the work day. It's just per hour. So employers are going to have to somehow keep track of every single hour.
I think that, well, the 387.6 requires them to maintain records of hour or daily hours worked. And any time
that daily hours worked, but not how much was earned per hour, right? So everything would have to change to comport with your position, right? Employers would have to start doing it hour by hour by hour. How much did they get per hour?
I don't believe it needs to be as rigid as that, because it's not how I've seen it applied in other contexts. But why I believe that is simpler is because the alternative is having to perform an after the fact mathematical calculation.
But isn't it going to be after that? I mean, it seems like you are turning every payroll period into sort of an hour by hour audit. And when it comes to commissions, many times commissions are calculated weeks or even months perhaps after the fact. And I guess what Chief Justice McKenna is asking is, how is an employer to comply?
Well, what they're doing right now. So defendants, as soon as this lawsuit was filed, transitioned all their workers to W-2 employees and started paying them the hourly minimum wage and plus a commission. So it's actually quite easy for an employer to comply with the law. They just merely need to pay the minimum wage for every hour worked, and that's easy to clock in and clock out and know what that
is. Even during the time that they're working for the commission?
Correct.
You're saying that minimum wage
correct.
Is being
they
paid?
Just, yeah, and I think that is the proper approach. I attempted to think of a situation where you can do it without, but most employers will pay the minimum wage and then which, again, doesn't do away with commissions at all. They're doing it now. And so do, they have all complete
what do they
flexibility.
Do? What do they do? Start adjusting the commissions to account for the minimum wage that they're now paying?
Yes, they reduce the commission somewhat. But, I think that the fundamental purpose of minimum wage law is economic security. And knowing that you're going to have a wage up front guaranteed for every hour worked is worlds apart than spending an entire shift. One of our plaintiffs had a shift that they worked the entire year. They're there for 6 hours. They never had a customer once during that shift. And so they had to hope and pray that they would make more commissions during other shifts. But again, the burden shouldn't be on the employee. The employee should have that basic understanding and comfort that they're going to have make a basic minimum wage for every hour. And I know that this is kind of an extreme example, and I think even the FLSA cases that they cite, I don't even think that none of them have dealt with this situation. But this is why this is like the best case for illustrating the problem with this work week averaging, is that the other FLSA cases dealt with application of FLSA, where it's been actually codified into the statute, but they dealt with situations of underpayment. So even though they were on commission-based systems or piece rate, they still were earning wages for each of those hours. They might have been below the minimum wage, but they weren't dealing with this precise situation.
So, Ms. Harmson, one quick question. So, are you, if the court adopts your interpretation, is your position this is limited to commission only type situations or other situations where there are alternative systems of compensation like waitresses, tips, and that sort of thing?
Sure. I think it applies. I think it applies everywhere. Tips are a little different, but another great example of Hawaii applying averaging to tip income only, but requiring an hourly wage. But it's applicable to all sorts of compensation systems. And the beauty of it is, again, to comply, you just pay the minimum wage per hour, and you're free and flexible to provide any sort of other types of incentive-based compensation system on top of that. And I wanted to quickly touch upon, I know it's not necessary to the argument, but I think that the rest of the statutory framework is very important too. Chapter 388 is just something else altogether. And the district court found that plaintiffs had stated a plausible claim for non-productive time off the clock work distinct from minimum wage and overtime. And I think, you know, 388 is designed to tell us how and when they need to be paid and to protect against unlawful withholding of wages. And 387 tells us what they need to pay, what amount. And so those work in concert together. And so if there's could be liability under 388 for those unpaid wages, we look to 387 in the absence of a regular rate of pay to see what that wage would be. And in this case, it would be the minimum wage.
Do you wish to reserve your remaining time for rebuttal?
I will, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Garrett?
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. Hawaii's minimum wage statute was modeled on the Fair Labor Standards Act. The workweek approach has been the law of the land under the FLSA for the past 80 years, endorsed by every federal circuit court to consider the question. Hawaii's Department of Labor and Industrial Relations has enforced the statute the same way for the past 40 years. And Hawaii's minimum wage provision is substantively identical to the FLSA. The plaintiffs asked this court to break from all of that, to divorce Hawaii law from its federal source, to override Hawaii's enforcement agency, and to effectively eliminate commission-based pay systems that have benefited Hawaii's economy and workers. The court should decline that invitation. And I think it should decline that invitation first based just on the text of the statute and the context, since this is a statutory interpretation case. Section 387.2 reads like Section 206 of the FLSA in that it talks about a wage at a rate of X per hour. I think the critical point is it's setting forth a rate of payment, not a unit of compliance. And so if you were, I'm not suggesting you should, but if you were to look at that provision in isolation, I think like the FLSA, it's ambiguous as to what the unit of compliance should be. But there are two strong textual clues that the Hawaii legislature has endorsed the workweek approach, and both have come up this morning. One is the dual coverage provision, and one is the tip credit statute. The dual coverage provision expressly talks about using the work week in the context of minimum wage. It says the FLSA presumptively applies, but if the minimum wage that may be paid to the employee under the FLSA for any work week is less than the minimum wage prescribed by Section 387.2, then Section 387.2 shall apply in respect to that employee for that
work week. How is work week defined?
Same as under federal law.
7 days? 7 consecutive days?
I don't know the exact definition. I know they said in adopting that language that it should be
Let me
same.
Ask you this. Under your interpretation of the law, of the legal requirements, what if you bring in someone and they you know, they're working 8-hour shifts and they work 4 days in a row and they don't get anything.
Right.
And they're like, I can't keep this up and I quit. What do they get?
They get all those hours paid at the minimum wage. They have to. The important thing is not to conflate the hours that have to be compensated with the measure of compliance. So we agree that if there are hours that an employee works that the law says you need to be compensated for, they have to be. They go into the denominator of the work week for the hours worked. And then you divide the wage by the hours worked. In your honors example, if they got zero, clear violation of the minimum wage law. They get the minimum wage for all those hours worked. We're not endorsing a rule that doesn't ensure payment for hours. They do get those hours. They're all counted. It's just their then compliance is measured in the work week.
You know, I'm still trying to figure out, where's the ambiguity in 387.2 where it says $16 per hour starting January 1st, 2026?
Sure. So it's what the work per hour is doing. It's saying wages at a rate of X per hour. As the U.S. Supreme Court said, Congress, in the context of the FLSA, by saying X an hour, they were setting forth the rate of payment, which makes sense. They're setting forth the sort of amount that you can calculate whether minimum wage was satisfied, and using an hour makes sense. But it doesn't mean that that's the unit of compliance. I mean, I can give an example, which is the EPA tells car manufacturers, your car has to meet, let's say, 35 miles per gallon. That's the rate, but they're not necessarily saying, we're going to check every gallon of gas you use and see if you use 35 miles. Why? Because mileage fluctuates. But so do incentive-based compensation systems. You know, right? You may have a server who comes in and makes zero tips, for example, setting up the restaurant, but then they get $100 or $200 during the dinner service. They fluctuate. And the work week accommodates that in a way the hour-by-hour approach does.
Do you think that adopting the plaintiff's interpretation would somehow discourage an employer from offering commission-type work?
Absolutely. Why? Absolutely, because a rational employer has two choices if you adopt the hour-by-hour approach. One is to eliminate commissions entirely, or number two, you adopt some sort of hybrid system, like what happened here, where you give an hourly rate but you reduce the commission. I think counsel said today that's what should happen. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what the Hawaiian legislature said should happen. They defined wages in section 387.1 to include incentive-based forms of payment. They endorsed commission, piece rate, and if you adopt an hour-by-hour approach, no rational employer will have that as a system of payment. They may adopt a hybrid, but it's going to be different, and it's going to reduce the upside to the plaintiffs. And you don't need to take my word for it. You can look at this case. They amended their retaliation claim in this case to say some of the workers were then paid less after we switched to the hybrid system. And they alleged that was retaliation because now they were getting paid less. Obviously, we dispute that, but it proves our point. You cannot assume that this hourly system is necessarily going to be better for workers. And I do.
Well, I was going to say it's interesting because, you know, it's a matter of security, as was argued by the plaintiffs, as opposed to what you're talking about. Is in certain circumstances, perhaps they'll make less, perhaps they'll make more under the hourly. Who knows? What depends on the circumstances and who makes an appointment. I take it at a hotel at a certain time for a massage. But going to the statutory language, what flashes to me when I look at 29 USC section 206A is it starts with any employee who in any work week
sure.
is engaged, right? I mean, that language is up front and center. That's not in our Hawaii equivalent statute.
I agree, Your Honor.
Right.
Can I give three responses and a brief preamble, which is the work week does account for security. It does account for the minimum wage. It ensures that when the employee is paid, all those hours they worked, they get minimum wage for it. It's just a different type of calculation. So it does protect that interest. But three responses to the work week. Number one, we know that the word work week in Section 206 is not what's doing the work here. We know that because the language was added in 1961 after federal courts and the Department of Labor had adopted the work week standard. Number two, that makes sense because if you actually look what the word is doing there, it's a prefatory applicability clause. It's saying the FLSA applies to any employee who in any work week is engaged in commerce. It's saying you have to be engaged in interstate commerce for the FLSA to apply. That's why Douglas made the point, this doesn't really answer the question because it's just telling you how it applies. And my response to why didn't, my third point is why didn't the Hawaii legislature adopt that language? Because it serves no purpose here. The Hawaii law isn't limited to interstate commerce. It applies to local purely local work. What did the legislature do the year after Congress added that workweek language? They modified the dual coverage provision to say, to determine which law applies, you look at the workweek. And again, I think it would be very anomalous to use two different standards, because what the dual coverage provision means is, and I think it's important to note, there were years after this when Hawaii law's hourly wage was lower than the FLSA. And so what the dual coverage provision was telling you in those years was, look, if you make over the Hawaii minimum wage but under the federal minimum wage, your interests have been protected. They said the reason we're enacting this is to give you the most beneficial law. But under their standard, there might actually be numerous commission or piece rate workers who would say, well, the FLSA hourly standard is higher, but I actually deserve much more under Hawaii law because I get minimum wage for the non-commission hours. So it doesn't make sense. The legislature was saying, no, you're adequately protected.
Well, I'm not sure it doesn't make sense when the text says the text. And the legislature, our legislature, clearly understood the word work week, clearly understood per hour. I mean, I look at the overtime provision. I look at the dual coverage provision that you mentioned. There's work week used. You mentioned the 1961 Congress adding in any work week. If we were truly going to mirror the FLSA, I'm not sure the point about, our statute, 387.2, excluding work week, suggests what you're suggesting.
I understand the court's question. Maybe let me say two things. One, to the extent we're referring to the overtime law's use of the work week, they had to. It's unlike other states like California, Hawaii measures overtime by the work week. And I would say what the Douglas court said, which is use of the term work week in the overtime provision, but not the minimum wage law, quote, could be read as exclusive, end quote, quote, but it's equally logical to conclude inclusion of the work week measure in the overtime provision means the work week is an acceptable compliance measure for FLSA provisions worded broadly enough to embrace it. And I think all I can do is return to my point that if anything, I think use of the work week in the dual coverage provision is an even stronger indication than its use in 206, because they are specifically saying when you are determining which minimum wage law to apply, we are endorsing a work week approach. I think that's strong evidence. And of course, it's not just...
Well, I don't know. Getting back to Douglas, I just read Douglas as using that in any work week language that's specifically in the FLSA, which of course 387.2 doesn't have, to show that it was ambiguous. But again, we don't have that work week language to suggest that our statute is them, you know.
My understanding is slightly different. What I understood Douglas to be saying is if you look at wages at the rate per hour, that's ambiguous. And the inclusion of the word work week doesn't solve the problem.
And I hear that your rate arguments, but when I look at our language, which is per hour, and I look at what per hour in its ordinary meaning is, which seems to be, at least according to Black's, each hour, and each hour is sort of a micro-grained level versus, you know, a broader work week context.
So I think I agree that I agree with the interpretation of what per hour means standing alone. All I'm saying is the work it is doing is setting the rate of pay, not the unit of compliance. And I think you can look at, I mean, counsel talked about Carranza and the Washington Supreme Court because they use that language too. If you read Carranza and Justice Yu's opinion the next, very next year, say, I said Justice Yu because she was the author of both, in the case called Sampson, what those two cases add up to is this per hour language is ambiguous and can be read both ways. The reason is the regulators in Washington said piece rate work shall be measured, and commission-based work shall be measured by the work week, but they exempted agricultural employees. In Carranza, they said that silence suggests hour by hour. In Sampson, they said this is a valid interpretation of what per hour means, that you can use the work week approach. So if you were to follow Washington law, what it would say is this language can be read either way. I do want to make sure, because the question was asked about the tip credit provision, I want to make clear the effects of plaintiff's position here. It has been, as I'm sure the court knows, the Hawaii legislature enacted a tip credit provision which says employers can pay under the minimum wage so long as the combination of tips and the hourly rate are some amount greater than the minimum wage standard. It has been the law since 1981, you see it in the enforcement manual, it's the law today, that they measure tip credit compliance by the work week. They have to. I mean, again, people get paid at different hours. There was a discussion about how do you measure, you know, when the commission is earned, when the tip is earned. Tips don't come in at a uniform time. If per hour is doing the work plaintiffs say it's doing, then the tip credit provision now applies hour by hour. That would be an absolute sea change to the bars and restaurants in Hawaii, which would now have to implement a system to figure out what hour was that tip made. We now have to pay minimum wage for the hours that the employee is setting up the restaurant or the bar isn't busy, even though they then go on to earn tips well above minimum wage in the work week. I think the fact that Hawaii has a tip credit statute, which a lot of the states they're pointing to, like California or Washington, do not, I know it's not explicit, but I think it's a pretty strong implicit indication that the legislature contemplated the work week as being a valid.
Is your response to their argument about the record keeping provision?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear
that. The record keeping provision
yes,
by
you.
Hour.
Yeah, so federal law has the same thing. Plaintiffs argue it doesn't, but it's because they cite the wrong provision. 29 CFR 516.2A7. Is the relevant provision. It says that employers have to keep track of work by the hour and by the work week, just like Hawaii law. And our point is that makes absolute sense. I work at a law firm. I have to keep track of my hours. I have to do it every day. I don't do it at the end of the, I'm not allowed to do it at the end of the week because probably wouldn't be as accurate. I think it just makes sense that there is a daily provision, and I don't think that answers the question.
You know, in this case, and we talked, and you were mentioning a hybrid system of commissions and, you know, other types of schemes, I guess. But here, the workers were not only getting commission, but when they were, let's say, waiting for commissions, they were actually doing other work that they were not being compensated for. And doesn't the per hour text of 387.2 sort of protect them in that sense for doing work? I mean, I'm waiting around for commission,
sure.
But nobody's here, so I'm going to make you go in and clean, you know, whatever. And that's doing work, but not getting compensated.
So let me take a step back and just acknowledge. I understand the concern that the work week is somehow going to lead to uncompensated hours and ensuring that workers are adequately protected. So let me say two things about that. First, like I said earlier, under the minimum wage law, any hour that's compensable and worked has to be part of the denominator. It has to be included. By the end of the work week, they have to have gotten at least minimum wage for that hour. So I think it does protect them. But what the minimum wage law is doing is ensuring that the worker is earning a minimum livable wage. And if you use the work week, it does that. It ensures they're getting paid a certain amount. Now, would there be other claims that an employee might have if they say, you didn't pay, you know, I'm an hourly worker. I came in and you told me you were going to pay me for this hour and you didn't. Of course. I mean, federal law says the same thing. You can have a quantum merit claim. You can have a breach of contract claim. All I'm saying is the minimum wage law is playing a particular role, which is ensuring a minimum livable wage. And as federal courts have held, it does that. It promotes that policy even through the work week. I do want to make sure I touch on the Department of Labor and Industrial Relations because I think it's very important here. I'm afraid I also don't have an answer to the question about why 1981. I don't know. This is, as counsel mentioned, we asked for all records to show what their policy is, and this is what we got. So I have to assume this has been the policy, and it remains such. I want to note, because this came up, this was a sort of point of contention in the briefing, this sentence, what does it mean in the manual, where the sentence says, a strict interpretation of the law would require payment of at least the minimum wage for each hour of work. However, for enforcement purposes, we permit employers to average over the work week. I submit that this is a classic exercise in administrative interpretation of a statute. They are showing they are aware of both potential readings. They are considering both potential readings, and then they're deliberately rejecting the hourly approach. I think that process, awareness, consideration, deliberate rejection, is precisely the kind of considered agency judgment that warrants some deference. And I would note, it wasn't some abstract idea. They then go on in the manual to give the precise methodology for how you calculate the work week, and they expressly said that employers of commission-based employees need only follow the work week provision. And I'll read it just because I think it's so forceful. They say, a worker employed on a piece rate or incentive basis is paid in compliance with the minimum wage requirement if the average hourly earnings for the work week equal or exceed the applicable statutory minimum rate. Why does it matter? Well, obviously, the question came up. Rose Hill, this court has obviously departed from the U.S. Supreme Court's Loper-Bright jurisprudence. The important part of this state is deferring to specialized agency, but I think it's more than that here for two reasons. Number one, Douglas, the Ninth Circuit's decision in Douglas made this point. This has been the enforcement policy since 1981. The Hawaii legislature has revised the minimum wage statute many times since then. It's a very heavily revised statute because they keep having to update the numbers. And they've never disagreed with this interpretation. And as Douglas says, that's evidence the legislature thinks they got it right. And number two, I just want to emphasize the reliance interests here. I mean, reliance interests are really important when you're forming employment contracts and deciding on a particular form of compensation. This would, a per hour rule, changing the rule, would upend the sort of expectation of the parties in how they are agreeing for compensation to work.
Back to the manual. I mean, it does say internal enforcement use only, you know, not to be disseminated outside the division. I mean, it looks like you want us to essentially give, let's say, legal effect to this document that they say themselves doesn't have any.
I understand. I'm not arguing for, pardon the reference to federal law, but like Chevron type deference. I'm not saying that, but I think that historically guidance manuals have gotten the deference they deserve, which is a circular way of saying the power to persuade, how persuasive they are. And I think my only point is they considered these, they adopted one, there's now been reliance on it, the legislature hasn't changed the law. And I just think it's important to go back to why the work week makes sense. And I go back to the 1940 statement by the Department of Labor of why they chose the work week. It was exactly this situation. It's in the record. If you look at it, they say, we're adopting the work week. We understand courts could disagree, but the hour-by-hour approach just doesn't work for incentive-based payment. They expressly talk about that being the impetus. And so I think
work week is explicitly used for overtime, correct?
Under Hawaii law and federal.
But it doesn't appear in the minimum wage statute.
I understand that, Your Honor. But my response to that is just that it has to be in the overtime provision because that's how overtime is measured by the work week. And I go back to what Douglas said about that sort of disparity under federal law, which is on the one hand, you could conclude, well, they included it in the overtime, so that means they didn't want to include it in minimum wage. But the other conclusion they said was possible, and I think it is that it just shows a comfort with the legislature with a work week approach, so long as other language doesn't foreclose it. And my point is 387.2 doesn't foreclose it, and the dual coverage provision and the tip credit provision strongly suggest they were comfortable with it.
But Hawaii law also has only requires payment of wages twice a month.
Correct.
Right?
Yeah.
So what if an employer decided we're going to start doing that as the calculation? Because the minimum wage says nothing about weekly or daily. We think we're just going to calculate it by the twice a month payment
I suppose that's why this court's decision is so important. But I'm not aware of that being an issue simply because I think employers are operating. They've operated under the FLSA for years in Hawaii. They've operated under Hawaii law and I think have pretty much assumed this is something they need to comply with.
So you're saying the FLSA would require weekly at least?
Correct. Correct. So it's hard to imagine them having a different different system. I think I've tried to cover the issues that have...
Oh, I'm sorry. No. Continue your thought. I have another question.
Okay. I just there was only one other point I wanted to make that I don't think I've gotten the chance to, which is, the per-hour approach, I think, has several administrative drawbacks. I mean, like I said, I think it's going to be very hard for employers to figure out what hour the tip was made, and I think that's going to give rise to a lot of satellite litigation over that question. I think you're inviting...
But how do you respond to opposing counsel's argument that all the employer needs to do is pay the minimum every hour, and then whatever commission structure you adopt, obviously, which now accounts for a minimum wage, is being paid to everyone?
Yeah, I think
consistently. Why is it difficult if we do it that way?
I think my response is that isn't an answer because the Hawaii legislature has told us that commission and piece rate payment structures are valid. They have endorsed that. And under they didn't say it has to be a hybrid system. They said you can have commission-based payments. And I think a per-hour approach effectively eliminates those forms of payment. So I don't...
Then why... since the Hawaii minimum wage law does not include work week, then why wouldn't an interpretation to say that it's the minimum per shift, why wouldn't that work instead?
Sort of like a daily standard.
Right.
I suppose the reason neither party has advocated for that rule is it again raises a couple problems. I mean, number one, part of what we're trying to avoid is Hawaii employers and employees operating under the FLSA already. I think there's some benefit to having one uniform system, especially when the legislature said they wanted these laws to work harmoniously. And I think it would still require, I mean, any, and this is easy for me, heads I win, tails you lose type of thing, but I think any change from what the current structure is will require a great deal of investment in changing tracking systems, whether it's by the day or by the hour, and I'm urging the court to avoid that. I think the current system's working. Sorry, Your Honor.
No. Thanks for answering the question. I'm just wondering if there's any kind of limiting principle. I mean, say an employer says to the employee or pays the employee nothing for 39 hours, and then on the 40th hour pays them $640.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what I mean by, is there any type of limiting principle there?
Yeah.
0000, but that last 40th hour, here's your $640.
Yeah, I understand. And I think the answer is that in that case, my point is the minimum wage law has been satisfied and that in the work week, they're making minimum wage. whether there would be other problems in terms of, like, if they were promised, no, I'm going to pay you at the end of every day, or I'm going to pay you hour by hour, and they don't do it. I'm not saying there's not other claims out there that might fit that circumstance, whether it's, you know, quantum merit or what have you, or some other, you know, they refer to Chapter 388. All I'm saying is, for purposes of minimum wage, that's not a violation. And I think you can sort of come to that conclusion by thinking, what if the parties agreed? What if they agreed, for whatever harebrained reason, you're going to work 39 hours, and then on the 40th, I'm going to give you this big chunk of change. And that's what the employer does. I mean, for minimum wage law, and according to the parties, it's not a problem.
So, well, don't we have a provision that says you can't make private agreements that, you know, can circumvent?
Yes, but I think that's the point I was trying to make.
I understand your point. Yeah.
Look, I think our bottom line is that, you know, this has been the work week approach has been the approach under federal law for 80 years. It's been the enforcement policy of Hawaii for 45 years. I think the system protects employers and employees alike, and there's and it accommodates incentive-based payments in a way the per-hour system doesn't. So we would urge the court to continue down that path. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Ms. Harmson, rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. So first, I want to address, because he discussed the text again at length, what defendants are trying to do is to import a work week averaging approach that just simply does not exist. There's no basis in the statutory text whatsoever. Opposing counsel also misstated, I believe, the reasoning in Xerox v. Douglas. While they noted that work week was part of a prefatory clause, they also noted that that denotes a measure of compliance other than per hour. And there are many, many, many cases have dealt with the same exact language, not just Carranza. And again, the holding in Sampson was just misstated. Work week was incorporated elsewhere in regulations. That was a special context where certain types of workers and industries were exempted, and the work week averaging explicitly applied. But opposing counsel is ignoring all of the body of case law from Georgia, from Nebraska, from California, other decisions in Washington who have dealt with this exact same language. And so we can't be importing a standard that it does not appear in any regulation, that does not appear in the text itself. Another point that I wanted to highlight is, in this particular case, you can see what type of abuse can occur with workweek averaging. And in this case, defendants would hire, and this is in Jeff Agin's deposition testimony, that they would hire so many more workers than they needed because they didn't need to pay them, and they didn't pay them. So for them, they could have 20 additional people waiting around doing other work and have no requirement to pay them unless they did have clients. So there was always an overabundance of workers, and there was no incentive to reduce their workforce.
But at the end of the week, they would at least receive the minimum wage, right?
They did not. No, and that's the abuse that can occur in under a system like this, because who's actually policing these big employers? And
if I heard counsel correctly, I think he said if that was a situation, you would still get paid the minimum.
He said that in theory he agreed with that. In this case, no one received wages unless they had a client appointment, and even then, they withheld, unlawfully withheld linen fees. They withheld a portion of their tips, and they would reduce their commissions unilaterally or sometimes comp them all together. They had no control over that. And so what we see here is just the actual extreme, which is why it's such a wonderful case for illustrating the problem, just total exploitation of having to be available and sit in a workplace, having no idea if your employer is going to give you an appointment. They can't even have their own customers, their own clients. They're forbidden from giving their contact information, from marketing their services. And then there's just this super abundance over supply of workers sitting around, which, you know, Hawaii, I also wanted to point out this was part of our the supplemental authority. We wanted the court to have the benefit of the full manual, not just those couple pages excerpts, because it's vitally important. Elsewhere in the document, it shows an intent of just the opposite of truly what the textual interpretation is waiting time. If the manual says if they're sleeping, if they could be called in, even if they're sitting around doing nothing, reading a book, this is all compensable time because they're suffered and permitted to work. They're under the control of their employer. They're not free to undertake other work. There's, you know, definite opportunity costs, and they're under their direct control.
Ms. Armstrong, can you address the argument that the tip credit compliance provisions are more harmonious with the weak work week analysis?
Sure. I actually think just the opposite. Because the tip credit, you know, explicitly there we do see, and we do see it under 387.3 too with overtime, an averaging approach adopted. It's still saying that you need to make the minimum wage an hourly wage, but there's a tip credit. You average tips over that period of time. So I actually think it supports plaintiff's position entirely, and I don't see it at odds at all with requiring payment at the minimum wage per hour. Those can coexist just fine. Tips can be average, and there can still be the tip credit. There's no reason why not. And because currently where employees are required to pay an hourly wage.
I recognize your time is up, but one last question from me, which is Mr. Garrett argues that adopting your position means for employers having to drastically change the manner in which they administer wages, particularly with regards to tips and other areas. Can you address that, please?
Oh, I don't think there's any basis for that whatsoever. That's what I was referring to in terms of tip income, because that's presently how the system works. If they get paid an hourly wage, and tips supplement that and are averaged across the hours worked. So I don't see those.
But how about the tip credit? Do they do it weekly, or do they do it daily, or how are they doing it?
I there's no specification under the tip credit as to how often that occurs. So I think it's more that they need to make the make sure that
there's tips, a lot of places that tips are like pooled and then they're distributed at the end of the shift. Right. It's not like an hourly thing, right?
Well, I it is insofar as they have to make sure that each I think more importantly, each of those hours needs to have an hourly wage attached. It's not averaging, you know, tips across unpaid hours. I don't see those as truly being in conflict at all. Lastly, he had noted that the law has not been updated, and I won't get into why it's not appropriate to say that DLIR has enforced this for 45 years when there's not a single evidence in this record or from the agency of it ever being applied. But Act 30 from 2022, very recently, the legislator updated the minimum wage statute. And reading just the preamble and intent behind that, wanting to protect workers who are very vulnerable in this state and wanting them to have a basic living wage, but also to increase the criminal penalties to align with other jurisdictions and other states who have taken a more protective approach than federal law. So I think there's, you know, even beyond the DLIR guidance, and like I said, elsewhere in that big manual, there's all these examples of time when you're suffered or permitted to work must be compensated at the regular rate, and we look to 387 to know what that rate is.
All right. Thank you.
Thank
very
you
very much. The court will take this matter under advisement.
Eku iluna, please rise. Ua ho o ko u ia mai ne ke aha ho o kolo kolo ki e ke hana hano o kamako aina o Hawaii. This Honorable Supreme Court of the State of Hawaii is now adjourned.